భద్రం కర్ణేభిః శృణుయామదేవాః భద్రం పశ్యేమాక్షభిర్యజత్రాః స్థిరైరంగైస్తుష్టువాంసస్తనూభిః వ్యసేమదేవహిదం యదాయుః స్వస్తి న ఇంద్రో వృద్ధస్సవాః స్వస్తి న పూషా విశ్వవేదాః స్వస్తి నస్తాక్షు వరిష్ఠనేమిః స్వస్తి నో బృహస్పతిర్దధాతు. ఓం శాంతి శాంతి శాంతి. ఓ ఆల్ మైటీ గాడ్స్, లెట్స్ బీ కేపబుల్ ఆఫ్ పెర్ఫార్మింగ్ అవర్ సాక్రిఫైసెస్ అండ్ అవర్ రెస్పాన్సిబిలిటీస్ అండ్ హియర్ ఆస్పీషియస్ సౌండ్స్ విత్ అవర్ ఇయర్స్ అండ్ సీ ఆస్పీషియస్ ఫార్మ్స్ విత్ అవర్ ఐస్. విత్ స్ట్రాంగ్ అండ్ స్టడీ లిమ్స్ అండ్ బాడీ అండ్ మైండ్ రిమైనింగ్ ఆల్వేజ్ ప్రేయర్ఫుల్, లెట్ స్పెండ్ అవర్ గాడ్ గివెన్ లైఫ్ డైరెక్టింగ్ అవర్ మైండ్స్ టు ఓన్లీ ఆస్పీషియస్ థింగ్స్. ఓం పీస్ పీస్ పీస్. Now, in the last class, we were dealing with a very important topic that is discussed in this Vedantic text. This Vedanta tells us that the reality is one, the supreme reality is one attributeless consciousness, which is the Atman or Brahman, as it is called, which is the immanent reality residing in all beings, which is also the all-pervading reality and the transcendental reality. This is the only truth. But in our practical life, we don't always realize this truth. We think of ourselves as psychophysical mechanisms. The primitive person thinks of himself as this body, which comes and goes, nothing beyond. And in direct proportion to our cultural and intellectual evolution, our concept of our own entity evolves. As we advance further and further, our own understanding of our true nature also improves, evolves. And a highly educated thinker may think of himself or herself to be a thinking, cognizing, intellectually enlightened person. A highly evolved spiritual person, a mystic, may think of himself to be the all-pervading spiritual reality. So, these are two levels of parallel evolution. One, our understanding, our cognition of our own true nature. And in direct proportion to this evolution, our understanding, our perception of the absolute reality also evolves. This is a very interesting principle in anthropology, of course, and also in theology and philosophy. In anthropology, of course, we don't normally deal with the spiritual aspect of it. They tell you, see, the tribal person or the primitive person who was a hunter-gatherer who lived in a cave thought of himself to be only a hunter, catching animals and cooking and eating them and taking shelter in a cave to protect his or her body from rain or heat. And so anthropology stops there, it doesn't go beyond that. But in philosophy and spiritual science, we find in direct proportion to our own evolutionary process, our understanding, our own perception of our own true nature evolves. No civilized person will be happy if you tell him that you are just this physical body, nothing more, nothing less. He would like to be identified as an intellectual, as a thinking person, feeling person. On the other hand, a highly evolved spiritual person would look upon himself or herself as something beyond all this, something beyond body, mind, and intellect. The one who is in direct communion with the transcendental reality. Similarly, a highly evolved person thinks of the absolute reality as something universal, all-pervading, that transcends all limitations. A highly evolved spiritual person won't be happy if you tell him that the absolute reality is just a creator God sitting somewhere who sets some rules and regulations, do's and don'ts, which he expects the whole humanity to follow. A highly evolved, liberated person thinks of the absolute reality as the immanent, the omnipresent, and the transcendental reality. Now, the question arises, why do we forget the fact, or why do we fail to realize the fact that we are this transcendental, immanent, omnipresent reality? We suffer sorrow, we are obsessed or enslaved by the senses, all because we don't remember or we forget the fact that we are something beyond this body, beyond this mind, beyond this intellect. Why does this forgetting occur? What is the process? In Vedanta, the answer given is this. It is due to Maya. That is the answer given from a philosophical angle. From a practical angle, this subject is dealt with here in this second chapter of the Mandukya Karika, in 9 verses from 20th to 28th verse. The philosophy tells us that it is due to Maya. Now, what is Maya? Maya is something which exists for all practical purposes. Because though we read these books, we think very deeply of these philosophical ideas, still, the moment we come out of it, we forget this. And even when we remember this, we are not able to act according to this idea. It is not intellectual ignorance that's a cause. Many people know, many people are familiar with high philosophical, spiritual ideas, but they are not able to put them into real action in actual practical life. What's the reason? There is an inexplicable, indescribable fact, which Swami Vivekananda calls a statement of fact. It's a fact of our daily experience, but we also know that it is not the whole of reality. So long as we are within Maya, we feel that it is real. But the moment we come out of Maya, we understand this Maya is in fact something non-existent. But we realize this truth only when we come out of it. This is the explanation from a philosophical point of view. From a practical point of view, Gaudapada says it is due to a process, a mechanism which he calls superimposition. Superimposition actually means you are seeing something, but instead of seeing that object and recognizing that object as that object, you think it is something else. In the well-known analogy, as I said earlier, you are seeing the rope, there is not enough light, and four people have got four different distinct perceptions of that object. One person thinks that rope is a snake because in his mind, he has got the object of the snake in his mind. He must have seen a snake in recent times in a zoo or somewhere. And the object that he sees in front of him resembles the snake that he remembers when he sees actually the rope. Another person may not be thinking of the snake. He has seen a curved stick just on his way while coming here. So he sees this piece of rope and he thinks it is that curved snake, something like that. Another person may think it is a thin stream of water. Still a fourth person may think it is a crack on the floor. You know, anything which is in a curved shape could be mistaken to be either a stick, a curved stick, a snake, or a thin stream of water, and so on. Depending upon the object that this person has in his mind or in her mind, which he superimposes on the rope. So the rope is the ground, and the snake which is superimposed upon the rope is technically called vikalpa. Vikalpa means what is superimposed, what is falsely, wrongly cognized. That is the meaning of vikalpa. So the rope is the aspada, adhisthana, the ground, and the snake is the superimposition. Now Gaudapada says, there are 35 types of superimpositions, 35 types of false cognitions, as he calls them. These 35 false cognitions can be analyzed in the light of the prevailing systems of thought in India during Gaudapada's time. Every single superimposition doesn't represent a particular school of thought. There are nearly 14 distinct schools of thought represented here, and there are also minor subdivisions of some central systems of philosophy. So I think the last class I already started this the discussion of these superimpositions. Now we'll continue. I think I have already dealt with the first 8 superimpositions. I have already dealt with, which are explained the 20th and 21st verses. The 9th superimposition is Veda iti Veda vidaha. It comes in the 22nd verse. In the 22nd verse, it stated Veda iti Veda vidaha. It's a kind of theological school. Now, sometimes you find there are people who tell you the absolute reality is this book itself. They will tell you this book itself is divine. In the traditional Vedic circles, it is called Vedaha Apaurusheyaha, means these Vedas did not originate with a person. These Vedas were not written by a person. Swamiji, in Swami Vivekananda's books, you find on the paper on Hinduism, he defines Vedas as the accumulated treasury of spiritual laws, spiritual truths, which were discovered, you should understand, discovered through introspection and meditation by the sages of ancient times. That is the true meaning of Veda. Veda, actually, from a Vedantic point of view, the word Veda itself means knowledge. So Vidhatu actually means knowledge. So Shankaracharya defines Brahmadhinam Paramatmanam Labhanta Iti Veda. So Veda signifies the absolute truth or absolute knowledge. It is not a name of a book. If you find there is a book in a library which is called Rigveda, Yajurveda, Samaveda or Atharveda, and you see that is the Veda, it is true only it's only in a secondary sense. In the primary sense, Veda means knowledge. And knowledge here, it is not objectified knowledge. See, when you see an object in front of you, you get, this is a book. So the book is objectified by your intellect, by the process of perception. So when your eyes and mind come together, they perceive the existence of the book. So the book becomes objectified, and later the book becomes verbalized, and you call it, this is the book. This is knowledge from a purely psychological point of view. Now, from Vedantic point of view, this is not knowledge. Knowledge is, in reality, the intuitive experience of the fact that is explained in that book, in the Vedas. That is the real knowledge. So words themselves do not constitute knowledge. The Vedas themselves tell you. That's a burden. That is the central theme of all the important Upanishads. Upanishads tell you this much. Well, these are the facts as far as human intellect can go. But the real knowledge is a matter of experience. And experience is beyond words. And that is the real knowledge or jnanam. That's what the Upanishads tell you. But there is a school of conservative, traditional Vedic scholars who do not derive their meaning of the word Veda from the Upanishads. Rather, they try to propagate the idea that the books themselves constitute the absolute reality. They will tell you everything is stated in the Vedas. Vedas are eternal. So when they say the Vedas are eternal, these conservative people who are deluded do not tell you that it is the experience that is meant by, that is the real meaning, the implication of the word Veda. They will tell you the book itself is divine. That is the wrong perception. Such people are called Vedavidaha. Veda idi Vedavidaha. Means those who understand absolute reality as the Vedas. Mostly those portions of the Vedas which deal with rituals, descriptions of different levels of existence, lokas, going to heaven and so on. Certain rituals, certain performances which are related to empirical knowledge or empirical pleasure. Most of these rituals are performed by people who want wealth, who want status, and who want progeny, who want to lead a very happy life in this world, and after dying, who want to go to heaven. Such people consider the Vedas themselves constitute the essence of the absolute reality. An extreme theological school. They are a fringe group of the ancient schools, which is known as the Mimamsakas, the school of ritualists. Now, Gaudapada tells, according to these people, Vedas or books themselves constitute the absolute reality. If you read the Veda, if you read a few words, then there is nothing beyond that. And then, yajna iti tadvidaha. There was a great philosopher in ancient India called Baudhayana and Katyayana. They were two great thinkers. They based their theories mostly on the ritualistic portion of the Vedic literature. Baudhayana and Katyayana. Now, and they also wrote certain secondary auxiliary books called Grihya Sutras. In these books, They explained how an householder should perform different rituals if they want to get wealth, long life, prosperity, status, worldly pleasures, and so on. Now, such people, and for that purpose, they prescribed different Vedic rituals. These rituals are implied by the word here, yajnaha. It means, so vedaha iti vedavidaha. Yajnaha iti chatadvidaha. Means yajnaha, means Vedic rituals. Rituals performed by householders. Mostly, these rituals are performed by married people with husband and wife. Together, they perform certain rituals, mostly involving fire sacrifices, in offering different offerings, different auspicious things on fire, sacred fire, like ghee, butter, rice, and sweets, and so on. So, according to one school of philosophers, or certain group of people, a group of people who believed that if you want to lead a happy life in this world and also in the next life, heaven, then you should perform certain mechanical rituals, mostly involving fire sacrifices. There are seven such yajnas mentioned in the traditional books, that is Sapta Havir Yajna. I won't go into those details right now. Bhokta idi tadvidaha. Bhokta. Now, by the word bhokta, it actually is meant by people who believed that the absolute reality is the one who enjoys this world. The absolute reality is none other than the Purusha who enjoys everything in this world. So enjoyment is for them the ultimate goal of human life. This is one school of thought. Now again, bhokta idicha bhoktrividaha. Bhojyam idicha tadvidaha. Bhojyam means objects of enjoyments. In fact, many of these explanations were given by not Shankaracharya, but some secondary interpreters. I told you earlier in the beginning of this class, Shankaracharya doesn't write anything by way of interpreting any of these nine verses. The reason is, he says, all of them are wrong. So what's the point of, what's the use of giving a long explanation of these false cognitions? All of them are wrong. Some people think Veda themselves constitute a sense of reality. Instead of conceiving the absolute reality which is immanent, omnipresent and transcendent, they think the way books themselves or mechanical rituals or just vital energy, prana, these are the different false cognitions. So there is no point in giving long descriptions of different aspects of false cognitions. So he doesn't bother about writing anything by way of interpreting any of these nine verses. But from other commentaries like Anandagiri Tikas and other super commentaries, you get a rough idea of what Gaudapada might have had in mind when he wrote these verses. It is something very interesting. You find the most primitive ideas, from the most primitive ideas to some higher metaphysical ideas you can come across in these 35 different philosophical viewpoints. From empiricism, utilitarianism, even hedonism, Epicureanism, pragmatism, idealism, for example, by this Vijnanavadins are idealist, ritualism, and so on. All types of philosophical ideas are hinted in these nine verses. That is why it is a very marvelous exposition. Of course, in brief, by giving a hint only, not by explaining, of the different schools of thought prevailing in those days. Now, bhojyam iti cha tadvidaha. Bhojyam, it means objects of enjoyment. There is a bit of humor in this. Who are the people who held this view? Mostly they could, you know, they were, see, Anandagiri and other commentators say, cooks. Now, if you ask a chef, a highly specialized chef, what is the greatest and most satisfying job in the world? There are many people. They will tell, there is nothing better than cooking. You ask a great musician, what's the most dignified, satisfying skill that you can think of? Music. But a person who is not interested in music may not share that view, may not agree with him. If you ask a football player, his whole ideal or her maybe is playing football. A painter, he will think that, well, painting is the greatest job. So you find all of us have got some idea of the absolute, some idea of the highest ideal. So bhojyam literally means an object of enjoyment. So Swami Vivekananda makes an interesting remark in one of his lectures. If you ask a cobbler, he thinks the best job and the most satisfying job is the job of a cobbler. A teacher will tell you that's the noblest, and so on. So here, depending upon, this is not the view of Shankaracharya. We do not know what Gaudapada had in mind. But those interpreters who lived closer to Gaudapada's time than us, may most of us, argue, it is a reference to a group of people who thought that the best thing in this world is to make something which other people could enjoy. Sometimes it is called a kind of utilitarianism. According to utilitarianism, you judge the value or importance of anything by the maximum amount of pleasure that it brings to the maximum number of people. That is the way utilitarian J.S. Mill and others, you know, Bentham and others. So it is something like that. That's according to some schools of thought. So bhojyam iti cha tadvidaha. So vedaha iti vedavidaha, yajnaha iti cha tadvidaha, bhokta iti bhoktrividaha, and bhojyam iti tadvidaha is a point. These are the explanations. So Anandagiri says, supakaraha iti vadanti in Sanskrit is saying. Supakara means professional cooks. So, supakaram, professional cooks tell you that the best thing in this world, the highest and noblest thing in this world, to prepare something which is very good, which tastes very well, that is the view of the supakaras. That is the explanation given by a later commentator. Anyhow, now next, the 13th viewpoint is mentioned here. Sukshma idicha tadvidaka. Sukshma actually means something subtle. Sukshma means subtle. So those who believed that the supreme truth, the supreme reality is abstract. It is just the opposite of gross. So the word gross is called sthula and subtle is called sukshma. So sukshma idicha tadvidaha means, according to some schools of thought, the reality is something which is very subtle, very abstract, not visible, not that which cannot be explained or described in words. That is the meaning of, in fact, that is the highest concept of reality. So as you travel from gross to subtle, you approach truth. The subtler, the closer you are to truth. This is the understanding. In reality, there is a grain of truth in this statement, because one word that is used to explain this inexplicable reality is sukshma. Sukshma means subtle. In the sense, it is something which cannot be perceived by the senses, mind, or intellect. In that sense, the reality is subtle. But then, according to these schools of thought, anything which is subtle is an aspect of the supreme reality. Even according to Vedanta, you know, Vedanta didn't say the reality is subtle in the sense that it cannot be perceived or understood, objectified by the senses or mind. If it is gross, it could be perceived, cognized. If it is subtle, it is beyond sensory perception. But they also tell you, Vedantins also tell you, this reality is beyond sensory perception, so it is sukshma. But this reality is our own inner reality. It is our own self. Yet sakshan aparokshan brahma. The Brihadaranyaka Upanishad tells you, this reality is, it is sukshma, it is subtle, in the sense that it cannot be perceived by mind or intellect or senses of perception, as we can perceive gross objects. But at the same time, it is not far away. It is our own inner self. It is the nearest to us, because it is our true nature. In that sense, it is subtle, but that is not the meaning implied by these schools of philosophers. They would tell you that anything which is subtle is true. That's the understanding. Then, sthula idicha tadvidaha, 23rd verse, sthula. Sthula means gross. It's a reference to one school of ancient Indian materialists. They are called Charvakas. Charvaka, the word itself means charu vak vadanti idi charvakaha. This is the Sanskrit definition. Those who tell you things which apparently please your senses. That is the meaning of charvaka. They will tell you this life is meant for enjoyment. Keep your body healthy, strong. There is nothing beyond this world. So make the best of this life. Enjoy. Enjoy this world. Don't think of anything beyond. They don't even see a ground for morality and ethics. That is the view of this school of thought. It's called sthula idicha tadvidaha. So according to later commentators, sthula means anything that is gross. So there is nothing beyond this visible, this intelligible, this empirical world. Nothing beyond that. They don't even see any justification for any higher value, ethics or morality. According to them, this world is meant for enjoyment. So there were Indian ancient materialists in Gaudapada's time. So he says, there are people who tell you that anything which is subtle, abstract, invisible is reality. And there are those who tell you there is nothing beyond what we can see around us. So they admit only the existence of the present. So you live the best of every minute of the present. The argument is this. This ancient school of materialists, they used to argue, first of all, they say, the five elements which constitute this body and this world, visible world, they constitute the supreme reality. There is nothing beyond that. There is neither past nor present. Sorry, there is neither past nor future. There is only the present. So, you make the best use of the present. Make the best use of the empirical cosmic phenomena. There is nothing beyond that. This is the view of Sthula Vidaka. And according to them, you know, this soul or Atman, soul itself, is part of human body. That was the view of these ancient materialists. There is no such thing as an all-pervading reality. The so-called soul or self is nothing but a part of the human body. Then, Murta Idi Murta Vidaha. And according to this course, they believe that a God with a definite form, attributes, name, characteristics, duties and responsibilities is the absolute reality. A God who creates this world, who defines who rules this world and who defines the eternal law or morality or ethics, and who supervises his creation, and who sees that his whole creation follows his eternal law. A kind of creator God. This is, according to them, the absolute reality called Murta. That means the personified. A God with a definite form, name, characteristics, attributes, duties, responsibilities, and so on. A well-defined, a well-structured God with form, name, definition, everything, according to them. According to another school of thinkers. So, Murta Idi Murta Vidaha. Amurta Idi Cha Tadvidaha. Amurta. Amurta is a reference to the absolute reality as understood by the school of Shunyavadins or the Buddhist school of philosophers who believe that emptiness or voidness is the absolute reality. I explained this at the very beginning itself. There were two schools of idealists among the Buddhists. One school was known as Shunyavadins. The other school was known as Vijnanavadins. According to Shunyavadins, the reality is called Shunyata. Shunyata sarvadrishtinam prokta samsarana jidehi yesham tu shunyata drishtis sthana sadhyan bhashire. This is the Sanskrit verse. I shall explain this. Shunyata sarvadrishtinam. Shunyata means emptiness. So emptiness, voidness, this is the absolute reality. This idea is clearly explained in a well-known, celebrated philosophical, metaphysical work. The name of the book is Mula Madhyamika Kariga, like Mandukya Kariga. This is also another philosophical work in verse. Mula Madhyamika Kariga. It is a very, very prominent philosophical work written by one of the greatest philosophers of all times. Maybe in India's philosophical tradition, after Shankaracharya, the most astute polemical, dialectical writer of philosophy was Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna is the author of this Madhyamika Kariga or Mula Madhyama Shastra. The work is known in 2-3 titles. It has been translated by many great authors, Japanese and also Tibetan Lamas, into English. So any of you are interested, you can read this book. One of the most celebrated philosophical works in world literature. Mula Madhyamika Kariga. According to Nagarjuna, Shunyata is the absolute reality. Shunyata means, literally it means emptiness. So you find in English translations of this work, the word shunyata is translated as emptiness or voidness with capital letter E or V in capital letter, because according to them, it is the absolute philosophical category. It is the transcendental reality. It is one without a second. It is the all-pervading reality. But it is voidness. So this is they are called they are the first school of idealists among the Buddhists. The second school of idealists is called Vijnanavadins. We will come to that later. It is called the subjective idealism of the Buddhist tradition. So here Gaudapada is referring to those three philosophers who are the followers of Shunyavada. It is related to the Mahayana branch of Buddhism, which was the prevailing Buddhist tradition in China, Japan, Korea, and a few other countries, many other countries. So that's one thing. So then the 21st school of thinkers, Mana Iti Manovidaha. So according to them, mind is everything. Mind, see, you perceive everything with your mind. But remember, this is not a reference to Vijnanavadins. Because Vijnanavadins also use a word which is similar to mind, it's called chittam. But here, that is not what is implied here. These schools of thought sometimes are allied to another school of ancient Indian materialism. It's called Lokayatika. They believed that world is perceived by mind, and mind is the absolute category. The world exists only as much as, or as long as, or as the mind perceives it. Your world is the creation of your mind. There's a little bit of truth in that. In fact, the world that we live is certainly what our mind perceives it. In Vedanta, so manaspandita means the world that we pursue, the world that we live in, is nothing but a vibration of our mental cognition. But they believe, this materialist believe, that this mind is the absolute category. There is nothing beyond this mind. And mind is always fluctuating. What is mind? Mind is nothing but a stream of consciousness which fluctuates from one part of the pendulum to other part. Either you perceive something one way or you pursue it in another way. So mind is nothing but an endless stream of consciousness, thought currents, coming one after another. That is what we normally mean by mind. So these people believe that mind is the absolute category. But then the next 22nd school of thought is referred to buddhi. Buddhi means intellect. Buddhi is meant nothing but intellect. This is also one school of Buddhists. Buddhists also believe that buddhi perceives this world. The world is nothing but what intellect perceives it. It is a part of this school of thought was a part of Vijnanavadins or subjective idealists called. So now I shall stop with this. We have already dealt with 22 different types of thinkers. It is not a very easy, it's not an easy process to keep all this in mind. I shall stop for some time. And if any of you need a clarification or any of these ideas, you can ask for clarification. I shall be happy to respond. Any of these ideas.
Did you take 24? I didn't take. I stopped with the 22nd
superimposition, which is the first part of 24th verse. I didn't go to the other part because of time. So, if you want any explanation of that point, chitta vidha, that is just a reference to subjective idealism of Vijnanavadins. I will deal with later because it needs a long description. So we may not be able to complete it today. So if you have got any doubts on any of these subjects or anything which we have been described dealing with during the last few months, you can ask.
Well, is there something considered the current school of thought?
Excuse me?
Is there something now considered the current school of thought?
The current school of thought. Well, in today's world, many of these schools have become extinct. The earlier schools I mentioned, you know. For example, people who thought a vital energy is the absolute reality, they no longer exist. And there are still some thinkers, not many, old conservative ritualists who will tell you that these rituals described in the Vedic literature is the absolute and there is nothing beyond that. But they are very, very small. They are very, very small. But I must tell you, whenever we deal with Buddhist schools of thought, the idealists or realists of Buddhism, they are still very much popular, and the two schools of Buddhist idealism, that is the school of emptiness and the school of subjective idealism, they are still very much popular in Far Eastern countries, including China, Japan, Korea, Cambodia, Thailand, all these countries. They are very, very popular. Buddhist schools are still very popular.
The idea of voidness.
Yes. Yes. Now, according to Nagarjuna, who is the original exponent of this theory of voidness, voidness is an absolute category. Voidness is something that you realize when you reach the highest level of nirvana. So Nagarjuna says that when you transcend the empirical, you realize the transcendental. And this transcendental is emptiness or voidness. And he says, this voidness or emptiness is non-dual in nature. When you realize it, you experience the bliss because you go beyond all trishna, means all desire, and you get completely freed from the shackles of karma, rebirth, and so on. You become a liberated person. You achieve nirvana. This is the concept. But remember, you know, the word voidness, or its Sanskrit original term, shunyada, signifies the absence of anything. But Nagarjuna did not mean that. In fact, Nagarjuna meant shunyada to be the absolute philosophical and spiritual category. So its literal meaning should be kept aside when you study Nagarjuna's Madhyamika Karika. And there I shall try to explain this in the light of a very important statement made by Chandragirti in his commentary on Madhyamika Karika. And Chandragirti says, to understand the true nature of emptiness, is very difficult. He makes a statement, even to define emptiness as emptiness is wrong. Because emptiness is not even emptiness. If you define emptiness as emptiness, then it is not emptiness. You are defining it. You cannot define something which is non-existent. So he says it is an intuitive experience. That's a point to be understood. So you find Nagarjuna comes very close to Advaita Vedanta when he tries to analyze emptiness or shunyata. And especially in Chandragirti's commentary. Chandragirti is the great commentator of Nagarjuna's famous philosophical work. I shall just narrate this point that may make it very clear. Chandragirti says, he takes an example from Ayurveda. And he says, suppose somebody is suffering from stomach problem. You have to take a medicine. Maybe, you know, these Buddhists were outstanding contributors to Ayurveda. Vagbhada, and Vagbhadacharya was himself a Buddhist. Many of these great writers of Ayurvedic texts were all Buddhist. Now, he gives an example. Chandragirti, no Nagarjuna. To make clear the true position of his master Nagarjuna, Chandragirti says, he takes an example from Ayurveda. Suppose you have a stomach problem. You take a medicine. Then he says, and your system is emptied. But to really achieve, to become completely cured of your problem, even the medicine that you have taken should also be emptied of the system. So he says, even to call shunya, shunya means emptiness. So let us use the Sanskrit term, you know. Shunyata is the word used by Nagarjuna. Even to call shunyata as shunyata is problematic. If you define emptiness as emptiness, then it is no more emptiness. If you define it, then it is not emptiness. So he says, to understand emptiness, you need highest spiritual wisdom. But then Nagarjuna also says, to achieve this emptiness, you have to transcend, you have to go beyond empirical. Nagarjuna accepts the empirical. Just like Advaitin's Vyavahariga, Nagarjuna also accepts the empirical. So if you transcend the empirical, then you reach the transcendental. When you reach the transcendental, you realize the emptiness. When you reach the emptiness, you feel yourself to be the absolute reality. You are freed from all desire, all the bondages and shackles of karmas, rebirth, and all the entire process of chain reaction. Which, if you go deeper into Buddhist philosophy, you should learn the meaning of Praditya Samudpada, mean the mechanism of coming into existence again and again. So this is the point to remember. Emptiness is not what the English word emptiness signifies. Shunyata is not the real word literally signifies. Its metaphysical, spiritual implication is beyond its literary implication. That is Nagarjuna. Okay, it's clear.
So you are saying, Swami, that after empirical, whatever is there, it cannot be defined. And that they call shunyata.
Shunyata, yes.
And other people can call it by different
names. But you know, Nagarjuna used the word shunyata. That's the problem. If he had used the Brahman or Atman, he would have joined Advaita in camp. He didn't do that. That's the Shankara's. But any please. Yes, yeah. It does sound like Vedanta. That's why, according to many Vedantins, you know, Nagarjuna came very close to Advaita, but then he took a negative turn, and he called it Shunyata. Shunyata means emptiness. But that's why commentators, Buddhist commentators, who originally wrote in Sanskrit, they stress the fact, Shunyata doesn't really mean what normally we mean by its English equivalent, emptiness, I mean, signifies. It is something beyond that. That's what it means. So I think we shall conclude now. Now, before conclusion, there is an announcement for you. We will not have class next Friday, December 7th. The next class will be on Friday, December the 14th. Please remember, next class on December 14th, Friday. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.